And with our special guest tonight, Lionel Fenthor, when we come back, we're going to talk about an incredible story, an investigation with Uri Geller. And also, did you know that Lionel has been re-examining the various myths of Atlantis? We'll talk with him about that as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie here, Lionel Fenthorpe in the United Kingdom, our guest. Now, you've got to tell us about this story with Uri Geller.
Well, this was one of the most amazing things that's happened to me over a 30-year career of investigating the paranormal and the anomalous, George. And Uri and I had been invited up to a very old house in Stonegate in York, which is the same place that we talked about earlier, where the young plumber's assistant saw the Roman soldiers walking through the cellar. Not the same house, but the same city, and not a stone's throw away. So this is a part of York which was saturated with mysterious things. And we had been over the whole house. We also had a psychic medium with us as part of the team who were conducting the investigation. And the general feeling that was coming through from her, and what Uri and I were also feeling, was that there'd been some terrible sadness in the place, that someone, a young girl had been, teenage girl had been held captive there, very badly treated, way back in the Middle Ages. And we had gone all the way down from the higher parts of the house, the attics and the bedrooms on first and second floor, and we were down in the cellar. Just below, we could look out through the cellar gratings, the kind of miniature windows that also ventilated the place, and we could see the feet of the pedestrians walking on the pavement in Stonegate outside the house. So if you could imagine, we're just below ground level, we're maybe 6-7 feet below ground level, or the modern, present-day ground level.
Okay.
And in the cellar, is it Uri and myself, and on the other side were two or three more investigators. There was no possibility whatever that this was some kind of conjuring or sleight of hand or prestidigitation. We were just standing, trying to absorb the atmosphere. And then, quite suddenly, it was not thrown. It just appeared, as if someone had picked up an object and placed it on the floor. It would be as if you or I were giving a lecture in a lecture hall and we'd produced an exhibit and just put it down carefully on the front of the stage so that our audience could see it. So there was no violent movement, but there was just a very slight rocking, rolling movement. And the object, when we got over our astonishment and picked it up and examined it, it turned out to be a porcelain or ceramic Victorian doorknob. So it was about 150 years old, and it was perfectly undamaged. It looked as though it had just been pulled off, because the square shank on which those old doorknobs used to work on the locking and door opening devices, there was a square aperture inside the object, and it was, you know, pretty clear to us that someone had, or some power had, simply removed it from the square shank that operated the latch of the door, and for some reason of their own wanted to draw our attention to it and had put it there on the floor. The only way I can describe it is to say that if the invisible man was real, he had concealed this somehow and stepped into the room and then laid it on the floor for us to see. Now, technically, in the jargon of paranormal investigations, when an object appears in that way, it's normally referred to as an apport. And the literature is full of cases where keys have just appeared like that, and where coins have sometimes appeared. But this is the first and only time that I have actually witnessed an apport, and with such an experienced researcher as my good friend Uri Geller in the same room, and he and I were both surprised.
I sometimes have wondered, with Uri's powers, if he, without knowing it, conjures these things up. And I'll tell you why, Lionel. I was talking to Edgar Mitchell, who was the Apollo 14 astronaut. He walked on the moon, and he tells an incredible story of Geller, that a long time ago, he, Mitchell, lost one of his very favorite NASA tie clasps. He just lost it. He didn't know where it went. And one day he was having lunch with Uri, and Geller was eating ice cream with Mitchell, and he had it in a little bowl, and he's, you know, got his spoon, and all of a sudden he says, what's this in my mouth? And he pulls out the tie clasp of a tie clasp. Well, Mitchell didn't think anything of it other than, my gosh, somebody dropped that in your ice cream when they were making it. Thank God you didn't swallow it, Uri.
Yeah.
A little bit later on, the two of them are standing up. Out of nowhere, from the ceiling, falls something to the floor. Geller picks it up, and Mitchell's tie clasp that he lost 2 years before was in his hand, was in Geller's hand.
Fell from the ceiling. Now, I think, you see, that that's a very, very interesting theory, that Uri has this strange power, and it's inexplicable, and it's wonderful. I can tell you two of the other things that we did. We were doing a whole day's filming for the investigation in this house in Stonegate in York, and in the course of our lunch break, we went into a nearby restaurant, and Uri said to me, Lionel, would you like me to bend a spoon for you? And I said, I'd love you to. And he said, okay, you choose any spoon from this table. And I picked up a spoon at random because the table was set for five or six people and handed it to Uri. And I watched him intently. And as a professional investigator, it's like being a police officer. You observe in a particular trained way. And there was no undue pressure. I saw his fingers moving gently backwards and forwards across the shaft of the spoon in much the same way that a gardener would stroke the petals of a rose. There was no pressure there. And quite suddenly, it was as though the metal of the spoon had become molten or plastic, and the weight of the bowl of the spoon just tipped it downwards. And it's in my china cabinet now with Uri's signature on it.
I love it. What a relic that is.
It certainly is. And then he said, may I show you my telepathy? And I said, Uri, I would love to see your telepathy. And again, being a trained observer, I had a notepad with me, and I made absolutely certain that Uri could not see how my hand was moving with the pencil. And what I drew was one of those little smiley faces. And he said, now I want you to put that inside your mind as if it's a picture on a television, mm-hmm. and project it. And he sat very silent and still for a few seconds. He said, I've got it. And he drew on his pad the exact smiley face, not just correct per detail, but the same size. We measured it. And I have that among my souvenirs as well.
I love it. Let's do a quick experiment, by the way. You ready?
Yes.
I want you to do that same thing with me. Project something, and I'm going to draw it. And as soon as you've projected it, just let me know, and I'm going to start fiddling with my pen here and see how close I can get. I could be way off, but I don't know. There's a connection.
Let's try it. Well, you and I are kindred spirits, so
okay.
Let's see what
we can. Clear my head, and then you do what you do.
Okay. Well, I'm doing exactly what I did for Uri. I have now drawn something on my pad, and I'm concentrating on it very hard. I'm thinking of you and of the show, and I'm seeing this picture in my mind as though on a television screen.
All right, and what I get, and I'm probably way off, but I get the picture of like a little house, almost like a log cabin with smoke coming out of the chimney.
Well, what I've got in front of me is not a house, but we're very close. I've drawn a pyramid, and a pyramid is a dwelling of the dead. That is, you see, the fact that you got the house idea and the idea of, you know, a dwelling place, a place that contained human beings.
Well, it's funny because I drew a square house and I put the chimney, real little tiny chimney, right in the middle. So if you were to draw 45-degree angle lines from the tip of the chimney, it would look like a pyramid.
Wow.
That's weird.
It is weird. And we just did it live on air for our listeners.
Have you ever investigated, Lionel, the 1917, two teenage girls from Cottingley, England, with those photographs of those fairies?
Yes, I have. I'm fascinated by that particular story.
They look like cutouts to me, but what are they?
Well, this is one of those, I think the most mysterious thing is that you have one of those stories in which it's a now you see it, now you don't, now you see it again. It's rather like the story of the Borley Rectory mystery, where there were genuine mysterious happenings, and then Harry Price, who was the investigator, was caught with a pocket full of stones, pebbles in his coat, and he'd been flicking them to try and make it look as if a poltergeist was making noises, and he got caught by a Daily Mail reporter. And then, long after the whole business of Borley Rectory had been discredited, other researchers in far more recent times recorded these rowdy voices in Borley Church. And so it was the place is haunted. Oh, no, it wasn't. Harry Price was a fraud. Oh, yes, it is. We've found some other honest researchers who have found phenomena there. So we come to the Cottingley fairies in much the same way. When the story first broke nearly 100 years ago, then the great Sherlock Holmes man, Arthur Conan Doyle, who was very interested in spiritualism, he took a personal hand in it and investigated, and the girls themselves, for many, many years, maintained that their pictures were genuine. But, like you, I get the feeling that what I'm seeing in those photographs is the kind of little cutouts that children in the period used to put in scrapbooks.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yet, there are other investigators who talk about the possibility of fairies or little people, for want of a better term, and Cornwall, where I've recently been working and investigating, is full of stories of strange little creatures that they call piskies, P-I-S-K-I-E-S, rather than pixies with an X. And it does seem that a number of rational, reasonable, sensible people have seen or have thought that they've seen these very small miniature human beings. Now, can we link that with what I thought was a brilliant idea of yours about the genetic engineers in remote past times? If they needed servants who could work underwater, and so they genetically engineered mermen and mermaids, could they possibly have required very small servants who would have been very dexterous and would have been able to get into places where normal-sized human beings like us could not go? So a race of miniature people would have been just as valuable to them as a race of underwater people. And in the same way, you know how the Bible tells us there were giants on the earth in those days. Is it possible that as well as creating these tiny people, there would have been some value in genetically engineering very big people to do heavy manual work?
Good point. Absolutely good point. By the way, I have a system here, Lionel, where people can send me instant messages on my computer.
Right.
Half of them say that they picked up a pyramid when we were doing this experiment in their own minds. The
wow.
the other half, get ready for this one, picked up a little house with chimneys.
Wow.
Now, isn't that weird?
That is more than weird, George. That is, you see, I think that one of the most interesting and valuable things we can do for our listener friends is to do experiment. It was a brilliant idea of yours to do this experiment after I told you about what Yuri and I had done. And then we've involved our listeners, and 50% of them got the pyramid and the other half got your house. That is, and so there's got to be a connection.
And one sailboat.
Yeah.
And there's one sailboat here.
And again, with triangular sails.
Exactly.
Yeah, a yacht.
You're absolutely right.
Wow. And again, of course, the Egyptian ideas and other ancient ideas about the ship of the dead. You see, this little square house with a chimney, again, has connotations of crematorium. And I have a student at the moment, one of my postgraduate students, a lovely girl who is doing some work for her master's degree on Etruscan tombs. And the Etruscans had various types of interment, and they also had various types of cremation. And the whole idea, they, the Etruscans, and this would link in again as another amazing coincidence, they used to make their tombs at one point like miniature houses, and they would put model houses, almost like dolls' houses, into the tombs, as though it was to be a dwelling place for the departed soul. So we link those together, then we've got the idea of cremation with the smoke from the chimney, we've got the house of the dead as on the Etruscan things, and who's to say whether, because I was recently helping this lady, she'd done all the research in the field, and had brought her notes back, and she and I were going through them together, so I was assisting her into, you know, categorizing her work. This, I think, is absolutely amazing, because perhaps in my subconscious, and I was working with her only yesterday, I've got the picture of an Etruscan tomb with a little house in it. I think and draw a pyramid, and you picked up my subconscious transmission of the little Etruscan house tomb.
That's fascinating. You know what? Because with the mind, when you try to transfer things with the mind, even if you're trying to concentrate on something like a number, I may do a little number game with you in a second. There's a 20% chance you're going to be right. But, you know, who knows? If you get it right, you know, the odds may go way up.
Right.
But I think when people are trying to concentrate, a lot of things go through their mind. And who's to say that in that brief moment when you were concentrating on a pyramid to project, you thought of this house in a very quick way, and maybe I picked that up real fast.
I think so. I think this could well account for some of the discrepancies that we get. It's rather as if you're writing a letter to a grandparent or a dear old uncle, and you are thinking in the letter, oh, I must tell uncle about what I saw in the shops last week, about the film I saw, about how the family are and the family pets. But while you're thinking of that and putting it in the actual text of the letter, your mind is also going back to the cinema and who you were sitting next to and the ice cream that you had halfway through the film. And these little thoughts come in almost subliminally. And although they don't go in the letter, they're present in your head. And if you were only sending a telepathic message to dear old Uncle John or whoever, he would be picking up some of the bits about the flavor of the ice cream, which you didn't intend sending him, as well as the exciting action in the film, which you were happily telling him about at a surface level.
It could be. It could be. And who's to say that, you know, here's another thing about the mind that's always fascinated me. You know, everybody in their life gets, you know, we've all lost our temper, we've gotten upset, and in so doing, weird things cross our brains. You know, if somebody gets you upset, you know, you may think for a moment, oh, I could kill you. Now, you're not going to kill anybody, but you think a quick thought, you know, in a moment of anger. What happens if your mind is so strong that it does these things automatically? That would be awful. You know, in a moment of a temper, it does something. And, you know, there could be no control over that.
I think that's amazing, George. I must tell you a little true story about my father. Many, many years ago, when he ran a small shop, we lived half a mile from the shop, and he was driving his car past what in the UK we call level crossing gates, and they come across and they shut off the road so the train can go through, and then you can go through again. And he was late for work. He wanted to get down there and open the shop, and the bloke operating a big wheel up in the control box for the signals, had started turning his wheel and closing the gates. And Father said, in that exactly kind of anger that you said, we'd never dream of hurting anybody, really, but he said, oh, I wish that idiot was dead.
Oh, no.
And the following day, the man died.
Oh, stay with us. Back in a moment. We'll be back in a moment, continuing with stories with our guest, Lionel Fanthorpe. And next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. You have questions, maybe you have stories you might want to share with us. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Lionel Fanthorpe. Lionel, in your neck of the woods, back in the 1800s, incredible stories about an individual named Spring Heel Jack. Ever stumble across that one?
Yes, I have, and he's a fascinating character. It's a mystery that's never been solved. He was operating mainly in London, and he would appear. He would occasionally blow fire, like a circus fire eater, into the victim's face, leaving them temporarily blinded. And he would then, when the men came out, he would attack girls. And when the men came out to defend whoever he was attacking in response to her screams, Jack would give a wild laugh and would disappear by these huge bounds that no one could keep up with. An Olympic athlete apparently couldn't have caught him. Now, he went to Aldershot, which would be probably something like the equivalent of West Point in the USA. It was a big military training establishment. Mm-hmm. And the sentry on duty was a good and honorable and brave soldier. And of course, he did. This thing appeared in front of his sentry box, and he challenged him. And the creature, Springheel Jack, as he was popularly known, gives this characteristic wild laugh and leaps up right over a sentry box, which must be a good 7 or 8 feet high. And the sentry came out and fired at him and was certain that he hit him. Jack just gave another of these demonic laughs and went leaping away. And when the sentry made his report, it was duly logged and entered, and his officer said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I'm also certain that I fired at him, and I'm not a bad shot." And Jack seemed to have been, on that occasion, impervious to bullets. On another occasion, and this was the most tragic one, because up to then, he had just seemed to be satisfied with frightening people and startling them. On this tragic occasion, because the London of the 19th century in the East End was full of poor girls who had no other means of earning a living.
Yes.
And one of these poor little kids was plying her trade on a bridge beside an open sewage ditch, which was, again, a feature of 19th century life in the rough end.
And the stench out there must have been incredible.
Unbelievable. And Jack, not only terrified the girl, but he picked her up and hurled her into the ditch. And before anyone could get her out, she drowned in that unspeakable mess. Now, as I said, up till then, it had just been a series of jokes. And a number of people were credited with being Jack. There was one famous aristocrat who had been a boxer and a high jumper and athlete at college. And he was the Marquess of Waterford. And it was generally thought that some of the Spring Heel Jack tricks were due to the Marquess, but he wasn't a bad man, he was just a joker. One of the other things could have been, you see, that there was more than one Spring-Heeled Jack. We find this, don't we, in criminology, that there are copycat crimes. And the last appearance of him would have been round about 1900 and not been seen since. But how to explain him, I don't know. All kinds of theories at the time. One was even that it was a kangaroo that somebody had dressed up in clothing. You can imagine a kangaroo trainer putting the guy into clothes. But Jack spoke to the victims on another occasion. He came to the door of one of the East End of London houses, knocked, and said, as though he was a police officer, "I'm a police officer. We have caught Springheel Jack. Please, can you come and bring us some light?" And the excited little housemaid came to the door with candles, only to find that the man who'd announced that he was a police officer was Springheel Jack.
A trick.
Yeah, and there were also rather unpleasant sort of sexual connotations. He would tend to tear the clothes off his victims before rescuers appeared, and he would then escape. But those victims who'd been attacked in that way said that his hands felt more like steel claws than human hands. They were very sharp, very hard, and ice cold.
Well, whatever it was, there's no question in my mind that there were real cases there. And, you know, whether he was a human being, some kind of creature, who knows? But these events were happening then down there.
Oh, yes, it really happened. You see, because I'm the eldest son of my father's second marriage, Dad's first wife died, and when he was 53, he married a 19-year-old who became my mum. And my old dad always used to say that he was the only man that he knew of who had two silver weddings, 25 years, with two separate wives. And he would laugh and say to me, "I never got the gold medal, my boy, but I got two silvers."
That's right. Nothing wrong with coming in second a couple
yeah.
times.
And what he also used to say was, you see, because he was so much older than me, he was 55 when I was born. So it was like being brought up by a loving granddad.
Oh, absolutely.
And he, being born in 1880, remembered the stories of Spring-Heeled Jack. And because he'd come from, as it were, so far in what was my past, he was able to tell me about the tales that you and I have just been thinking about, of this mysterious attacker who could escape by leaping over the heads of the people who were pursuing him. And Dad was quite sure, having lived through that era himself as a boy and as a young man, that Spring-Heeled Jack was not a legend. Spring-Heeled Jack was something that had really attacked young women.
Of all the stories you have heard in your career, all of them, which one have you found to be the most frightening, the scariest of all of them? Is there one that just sticks out in your mind?
Well, I would say, if we've got to pick just one, I would look at the tale of the Creeping Coffins of Barbados. From about 1807 until 1820, when Lord Combermere was governor of Barbados, there was a tomb that belonged to the Chase Elliott family. And that tomb, as it was at Christ Church at Oystens. And from 1807 onwards, every time a member of the Chase Elliott family was interred in that tomb, next time the mourners came around and there was another death in the family, the previous coffins had moved. And finally, Lord Combermere, by the time this was causing a scandal all over the island, he felt as governor he had to do something about it. And Combermere was a very powerful man. He had been a cavalry commander in Spain for the Duke of Wellington when they were fighting Napoleon. So this is not a man who runs away easily, and he was determined to get to the bottom of this. He called on the local minister, who was Father Orderson, the Reverend Dr. Orderson, and he said, "I want to seal this tomb after the next burial." So they did. And Orderson and the governor, Lord Combermere, and various prominent citizens all gathered. A huge blue marble Devonshire slab was placed over the tomb entrance, and the local prominent citizens made their private marks or put their signet rings into the wet cement. 3 months passed. No deaths in the Chase Elliott family. Combermere calls on the vicar again and says, "Right, we're going to open it and have a look." And as four powerful men lifted the blue Devonshire marble slab off the top, everyone having said that the seals were intact, a coffin was halfway up the steps. And Combermere said, "Right, that's it. We'll bury them all in separate graves." And that's what was done, and the tomb has stood open from that day to this. Listeners who are able to get to Barbados will find that the tomb is open for inspection. I did a radio documentary down there, and I had with me a wonderful guy called Emerson Clark, who was a Barbadian, and He was driving the car for me. The tourist board had laid him on to help me because they obviously wanted the documentary to be successful, for, you know, to attract friends to Barbados. And I said to Emerson, as I stood at the bottom of the steps with Patricia, I wanted another male voice. He had a lovely, rich, deep voice. I wanted another male voice on my documentary. And I said, Emerson, would you come down here with me so I can interview you about your knowledge of the tomb down here? And big, strong man. And he smiled and said, after what my grandmother told me, I'm not coming down there.
I don't blame him.
But then he changed his mind and said, Lionel, if you're there, I'll come. And I said, Emerson, that's a great compliment. And he came down with me, and we made, well, his contribution to the documentary was great.
Do you remember?
Your strangest place I've ever been.
Do you remember the phrase, dead ringers? And wasn't that from the bubonic plague during the period of the 1800s, where they attached a string to people that they buried, Lionel, and then a bell was outside of the casket above the ground, they're already buried, and if anybody woke up, they would pull the string in panic because they had been buried alive, and the bell would ring. Is that how that happened? Is that true?
I certainly think it is. When we have an interesting phrase or saying, there are etymologists who will look for its origins, and that is an ingenious theory of the origin. Now, there's also a much more, and I have every reason to believe that this is true, because the fear of being buried alive. I can remember my grandmother telling me of an elderly member of her family, going back way, well, now to perhaps the 1800s, and this old gentleman had left instructions in his will that the doctor was to open a vein before he was taken away in a coffin, just to make absolutely certain that he was dead. And the fear of being buried alive is one which I think a number of people have, and the horror of waking up 6 feet underground inside a casket and realizing that you've got about 20 minutes air supply left and there's no chance of anybody hearing you crying for help. So the idea of a string with a bell is certainly an intriguing one. And what we also have to remember is that the London cemeteries, before the big sort of, as it were, local government cemeteries were built in the 19th century, the graves around the London churches were getting so full, and the churchyards were getting so full, that coffins were only being put down a few feet and sometimes just a few inches. And this was why, because of the health hazard, that it became necessary to build the big London cemeteries. And the thought of churches of this kind having a coffin just a few feet or a few inches below the surface, then somebody could have shouted for help. But the idea of a bell and a cord on the toe or even on the hand, dead ringers, it fascinated.
Pretty ingenious, wasn't it?
Very good indeed. And it's a good way of thinking, because of the fear of being buried alive. And another thought, there was an Edgar Wallace story with a hero called the Ringer. And in his case, it meant the Ringer of Changes, because he could disguise himself in the Edgar Wallace thrillers as anyone. And the basic idea there of a dead ringer is one that is so similar that you cannot tell the difference. That's an alternative theory, but I like the one about the plague victims and the burial alive. I think that's the one.
My modern version of that, Lionel, was that this old man was just petrified of being buried alive. So he told his kids, he said, look, if for some reason I pass on, just to be on the safe side, please put a cell phone in my casket, because this fear, this horrible phobia I have of being buried alive, I just can't stand it. And, you know, they kind of laughed at him, but to appease him, they said, sure, Dad, sure. So sure enough, the old man dies, and one of the three kids said, you know, we have to put a cell phone in his casket. And the other two kids, you know, said, come on now, he's dead. And he said, no, we promised him. So they did. And sure enough, Lionel, he was alive. He woke up in his casket, buried 6 feet under. He's reaching around, I mean, in a panic, if you can imagine. He grabs the cell phone, pulls it up to his nose, his face, turns it on, and it says, no service.
Wow.
I made that up.
I think that's brilliant, yeah. And I think it would probably have actually happened, because there are places in our house, if I'm using my cell phone down here in my downstairs study, it won't give me service. If I go up to the first floor and stand in the bedroom, sit near the bedroom window, I get 5 bars, which is maximum signal. But just those few feet. I've never tried it from the cellar, because this is an old Victorian house and we've got a deep, old-fashioned cellar. I will have to, having heard that story of yours, George, I'm going to have to go down to the cellar and see if my cell phone will work.
Absolutely. Fully charged, too, by the way.
Fully charged.
The legends and the myths of leprechauns in Ireland, are they real? I mean, how could these people talk about these small creatures with tremendous powers unless something was happening? What are they?
I certainly believe that many of the leprechaun stories, and there were other little creatures there which they called cluricones as well, and they're so similar to the stories that we heard when we were down in Cornwall of the Cornish piskies, and we were talking earlier about the Cottingley fairies. And I think that going right back to your ingenious theory of the genetic engineers who decided they wanted very small people, or sea people, or giant people, and to do their work. They were just utilitarian genetic changes. And why not these little leprechauns and cluricones being real, being produced for some purpose? And when we think of their abnormal powers, in all the stories, they do have these great powers. Link that in with our thoughts about the powers of the mind and telepathy, telekinesis, teleportation, because all these strange little people seem able to teleport. They can vanish and suddenly appear. And that would be a very, very useful thing for the genetic engineer masters who'd created them. If you had a useful little robot or android, and you had endowed it with powers of teleportation, you could send it from Ireland to Scotland to England, anywhere you wanted, and it would appear and reappear, rather like Beam Me Up, Mr. Scott in Star Trek. So I think they may well have been there. Whether they are still there, I'd love to meet one if they are.
Did you ever come across stories of like strange pets? Almost like Stephen King's Pet Sematary, but really strange things.
Well, one of the first stories that comes to my mind as an East Anglian, and from that article that you recently did with Patricia for 14 Times about haunted East Anglia, there are two stories of a ghostly dog. And in the first one, he is benign, loyal, and faithful, like the better-known Grey Friars Bobby of Edinburgh, who, when his master died and was buried, followed the procession and then never left his master's grave, and the people of Edinburgh took pity on him and came and fed him. And in Norfolk, we have the story of the benign Black Shuck, who belonged to two brothers who were fishermen. There was a tragic storm. Their boat was wrecked. The boys drowned and were buried in two different villages where their bodies were washed ashore. And the faithful dog who loved them both would run from one graveyard to the next, night by night, to spend time with each of his beloved masters. The other story is of the East Anglian hellhound, known as the Black Dog of Bungay, which actually broke into a church during a terrible storm in the Middle Ages and killed 3 of the worshippers.
Well, Lionel, I tell you what, our last hour, let's do something a little differently. I do want to do one mind experiment with you again to see if it works.
Yes, of course.
But let's let people, if they want to ask you a question, that's fine. But let's ask them to share with us one of their best stories. Could be one of their scary stories. Who knows? It may lead to another investigation for you. You want to?
Yes, I'd love to do that.
All right, that's what we'll do. If you have questions for our guest, Lionel Fanthorpe, go ahead. We can do that. But I'd like you to share one of your scariest stories that you've ever been told when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.